is First Coast Connect. Good morning. I'm Charles Griggs, sitting in for Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. And just ahead, new concerns about the Delta variant of COVID-19. Give us a call if you want to join in on the conversation, 549-2937. Then later, a conversation with former Jacksonville Sheriff Nat Glover, who was recently inducted into the Florida Law Enforcement Hall of Fame. But first this hour, in a recent report that is now only issued weekly, the Florida Department of Health recorded more than 10,000 new coronavirus cases on Friday, bringing the total number of cases in the state to 2,310,881. That represents a 3.3% positivity rate. However, here in Northeast Florida, COVID-19 numbers are starting to tilt upward once more. Duval County's new case positivity climbed this week from 5.2% to 6%, highest among Florida major metropolitan counties, and that's not good. The state also reported the state's cumulative death toll had risen to 37,555 people. Meanwhile, new vaccinations have dropped and have decreased with slightly fewer than 200,000 reported during the June 11 through 17 week, Florida's smallest week-to-week increase in vaccination counts in 2021. Now, amidst all of this, the CDC director said Friday that the Delta variant of COVID-19 is expected to become the dominant strain in the United States, and it's further the reason why people need to ramp up the vaccination pace. Dr. Jeffrey Goldhagen is the chief of Division of Community and Societal Pediatrics at UF Health in Jacksonville and president of the International Society of Social Pediatrics and Child Health. He's on the line now with more on this, and we're going to try to have a very robust conversation about how individuals can protect themselves from COVID-19 and how we should be concerned about people who can't be vaccinated, like children 12 and under, from this virus. You can give us a call at 549-2937. Dr. Goldhagen, good morning.
Good morning, Charles. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being on. What do you think are the reason why we're seeing our positivity increase here in Duval County?
Well, it's pretty clear. We have a decreased number of people being vaccinated. The virus is still circulating around our community. The Delta variant is in particular one that will be increasing. And so the expectations are clearly favoring an increased number of coronavirus infections, an increased infectivity rate. And my concern in particular is related to children. Right now, we're seeing adolescents representing an increasingly significant number of or percentage of people who are being hospitalized and who are getting the disease. So we've been very prescient in the past. Epidemiologists have been able to predict changes that will be occurring in the future in the past. And we're predicting increased numbers of cases with respect to children in particular because of the Delta variant.
So one of the things that's very sort of confusing to people in the community is the Delta variant itself. You know, folks believe that we were told that we got tested, we social distanced, did the hygiene, then we got vaccinated. And now there's something called the Delta variant. Can you explain the difference between the Delta variant and what we've been encountering with COVID-19 up to this point for a year and a half?
Well, the Delta variant is COVID-19. It's just a variant of the original virus. Viruses mutate all the time, constantly. And those mutations that are more effective at infecting individuals then become dominant. So the bad news is the Delta variant is increasing. It has increased infectivity and increased amount of pathology. That's the bad news. The good news is that our current vaccines do protect us against that variant, which makes it increasingly important that individuals who haven't been vaccinated get vaccinated. The variant will act just like any other virus, and that is when our community reaches herd immunity, the variant will stop circulating like any virus would.
Yeah, what we know about the Delta variant, it seems to impact children and adults under the age of 50. And I know that you mentioned that you're concerned with the children. So what should we be doing, the best way to stop this, besides getting people vaccinated?
Well, from my perspective, the decision to allow people to be unmasked in public spaces inside was a profound disregard for children in particular. So children cannot be vaccinated. They are still susceptible to the disease. There were 14,000 cases of COVID in children last week around the country. And so, and they're representing increased numbers of cases of hospitalizations and in intensive care visits in hospitals. And so children are profoundly, profoundly being disregarded by virtue of having people unmasked. And so at this point in time, we need to be maintaining the mask requirements where children are. That's indoors. Outdoors is another story. The evidence is pretty clear that, in fact, there's relatively low risk for transmission of the disease outdoors. But wherever children are, we need to be maintaining a very rigorous mask requirements and social distancing.
Yeah, so one of the challenges that we have as a community is that people have been ready to get back to normal. People who have become fully vaccinated, in some cases people who have only had one dose of the Moderna or Pfizer shot, feel now, you know, safe, for lack of a better term. And they have been, we have been integrating ourselves back to, quote, normal. With the school year coming up, we're almost halfway into the summer for students, and students will be getting ready to go back to school. We've seen some of the practices that the districts will be utilizing are going to look a lot different than they were going into the beginning of last school year. Should we be concerned that, like you mentioned earlier, that students probably in most cases will be attending school without being masked, without some type of mask protocol in place? What are we risking with this?
Well, my perspective is politicians don't seem to be concerned, but parents need to be concerned. So parents should not be bringing their children into places where, in fact, other individuals are not masked. That's the first thing. They should not be in restaurants. They should not be in public transportation. They should not be in indoor sports events. Where, in fact, people will be unmasked, and their children who are unvaccinated will be susceptible to a disease that is still circulating around the community and for which children can be infected, can be hospitalized, can get the disease, can be long haulers, and can die from this disease. So parents need to be very, very diligent about placing their children at risk. With respect to the schools, that's a very complex question. We know that schools in the past did not seem to be the super spreaders that we had anticipated they would be. However, if there are opportunities for teachers and other people who work in the schools to be vaccinated, my perspective, although it may not be the most popular, is that if individuals are going to work in schools and children are going to be unmasked and they are going to be unmasked, then by definition, they need to be vaccinated. There are hospitals now around the country that are requiring their staff to be vaccinated. The courts have upheld their right to require individuals who work in the hospitals to be vaccinated. And I would extremely favor requiring those individuals who come into contact with children who cannot be vaccinated, that they should be required to be vaccinated.
So as we continue to take precautions for children, we have a question from a listener who wanted to know if an adult is fully vaccinated, should they be concerned about exposure to a child who hasn't been vaccinated?
Well, the data is pretty clear that, in fact, there is relatively low to extremely low risk for an individual who has been fully vaccinated, and that means two shots if it's required, that they are not carriers for the disease, and so that they should not be fearful of exposing their children.
So, and in doing so, as we continue to try to figure out ways, because a lot of people, you know, most people in the public, they have drawn a line in how they approach response to COVID-19. And many people are really sort of kind of getting to know this concept behind how the variant is impacting our community. What we're probably seeing is what we've seen in other countries, and people don't believe it until the variant actually starts to take hold. Recommendations outside of masking and social distancing, we should still be doing those things in accordance to the previous CDC recommendations. And how do we reconcile with the continuing changes that are made, the recommendations that are made by the CDC? And many people who are pushing back on some of these recommendations are saying, you know, their perception is that they don't know what they're talking about.
Well, our country has failed miserably. We have 600,000 plus people that have died unnecessarily. COVID has become a political issue. And so to reconcile this at this point, it is an impossibility. And so what this now means is that individuals need to take the responsibility for themselves. And with respect to children, their parents need to take the responsibility for themselves. And in the case of children, they need to be critically diligent about protecting their children from the disease, and in particular now from the variant, which seems to be more infectious and cause more pathology in children. So now it's become an individual responsibility, as our politicians have negated their political responsibility to protect us. Amongst the 600,000 people who have died, I don't know an exact number for sure, but hundreds of thousands of them have died unnecessarily. In our state, Governor DeSantis is responsible for the direct and indirect death of thousands, tens of thousands of individuals in our community and our communities around the state. Now it's critically important that individuals, and in particular parents, take the responsibility to protect their children who at this point cannot protect themselves.
Yeah, so Dr. Gohagan, I want to address this part as well, because you are a vocal respondent, public health official voice in the community. You were the former director of the Duval County Health Department. And I think people in the community not only want to listen to elected officials, but they also want to listen to trusted voices. How do people like you and others who are a part of the healthcare community, who, you know, strive every day to try to protect the community, how do you advise as a collective, advise on how this community can better take care of itself related to a response such as to this pandemic?
Well, Charles, that's a challenge. A number of months ago, our medical community came together to create the Population Health Consortium of Northeast Florida. Those groups include the Duval County Medical Society, Northeast Florida Medical Society, which is the African American Medical Society, the Health Planning Council, the Black Nurses Association, and upwards of 20 other organizations came together to establish a unified voice for population health, for public health in our community. We've been working through the media and other outlets, including community meetings, to ensure the information is disseminated through our community. Unfortunately, public health in our state has been dismantled. It has been centralized. It has become political. And evidence-based information has not been forthcoming and has not been disseminated in our community. You can hear the frustration in my voice, and frankly, it's a little maudlin, but you can't feel the pain in my heart relative to the fact that thousands of people have been infected, tens of thousands have died in our state, thousands have died, over 1,500 have died in our community alone, most unnecessarily because of the politicalization of this epidemic.
Yeah, we just heard prior to our broadcast, we came on the air, a story regarding Manatee County and how the government building had to be shut down because of COVID cases in the building there. And apparently, the people who were fully vaccinated were fine. So it sounds like that you're trying to continue to energize or at least bring information to the entire community, regardless of what political affiliations you may encounter. At the same time, we're still in the middle of a pandemic, and we have to make sure that the community continues to receive information about, so they can be better informed, they can make their own choices, the best choices available. Let's talk about a little bit about access. We know that last Friday, state-run vaccination sites were closed. That was the last day on the 18th. Previously, the FEMA site at Gateway closed down along with its affiliates. How do you advise people now, and what should people take away from these community sites being closed, no longer available within these various locations that we have been accustomed to for the last few months? What's the takeaway from that, and what is your best advice for people who are seeking to get vaccinated?
Well, that's been an interesting process over since the beginning of the pandemic related to access to testing and now access to vaccination. Certainly multiple sources of vaccination from pharmacies and grocery stores and so on and so forth does make it available to individuals. In low-income and minority communities, that access is decreased because of the relative lack of pharmacies and Publix and Winn-Dixie's and so on and so forth. So there still remains an inequity in access. What I thought was wonderful, and I need to commend the school system, Dr. Green, and her staff in particular, in now opening schools for vaccination. I'm old enough to remember the polio vaccine and other vaccine initiatives that opened schools. That's where we got our vaccinations. And so going back to where we were 40 plus years ago, 50 years ago, 60 years ago, to open up our schools as sources for vaccine is a tremendous step forward. There are hotlines that are available to identify where people can get the vaccine. So now there's movement to bring vaccine. Agape, as an example, the Federally Qualified Health Center is moving vaccines into the community. We have a $1 million grant that we hope we'll be getting through the consortium in the next week or so to be able to expand access to vaccine in the communities. So there are efforts underway to expand vaccine access, and we just hope that, in fact, people take advantage of it. And for those who have children between 12 and 18, that they get their kids vaccinated as well.
Okay. Well, thank you for that, Dr. Jeffrey Gohagan, Chief of Division of Community and Societal Pediatrics at UF Health and President of the International Society of Social Pediatrics and Child Health. We are happy to have you join us to have this conversation today, and we will continue to follow progress of our response in this pandemic. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Charles.
Okay. Later in the hour, why today is the perfect day to give yoga a try. But up next, former Jacksonville Sheriff Nat Glover on the need for police and criminal justice reform. Welcome back. Former Jacksonville Sheriff Nat Glover was recently inducted into the Florida Law Enforcement Hall of Fame. Glover served as the first African-American sheriff in Florida since Reconstruction. He spoke with Melissa Ross about the need for police and criminal justice reform.
Nat Glover, it's a pleasure. Good to talk to you.
Good talking to you too, Melissa.
And congrats on the recognition. This is timely to speak to you about this. You have a really informed perspective on law enforcement and police reform, this national conversation that we're having about Black Lives Matter. Where do you fall down on this issue of police reform? What do you think needs to be done to have an effective police force, but one that also has the trust and respect of all different communities?
Well, certainly, I'm a proponent of police reform. I look at this time as a time of reckoning, but I also think that we must take advantage of this opportunity. And when I say we, I'm actually talking about law enforcement and the community as well. The community, of course, needs law enforcement agency that they can trust and that certainly demonstrates the kind of integrity that would warrant that trust. And of course, you don't get that free. You have to earn it. So now, as we enter into these troubled times in law enforcement in general, I think we take advantage of it, and law enforcement and the community come together and come up with the kind of reforms that both can live with, and it will the law enforcement community will engender the mm-hmm. trust of the community.
As an African American and the first Black sheriff in Florida since Reconstruction, you carry a lot of credibility when you talk about these issues. You recently penned an editorial that ran locally, and you called the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis as one of the most profound American tragedies. And so, looking at that video was difficult for all of us, but I'm sure it was especially difficult for you. What would you like to see happen to reform not just the police culture, but the criminal justice system in America?
Yes, and when you look at the criminal justice system is just not police. The police is certainly included. It's the police, it's state attorney, it's actually the judges and the correction system. So it's the entire system. So I think the George Floyd incident kind of brought an awareness to some challenges that we have in law enforcement. And I also believe that it's been years coming. There have been questionable actions in law enforcement that certainly needed to be addressed. You can go all the way back to Rodney King and some of in that incident. So the George Floyd incident was tragic, and certainly it's unfortunate that we had to lose a life, but I will say we should take advantage of this. And when when I wrote my editorial, I said if we pass up this opportunity, it would be almost criminal to, you know, we would just defy history. I would hate to have to leave this problem for our upcoming generations. So we just need to have more open discussion about it, community and law enforcement, and so that the community can trust law enforcement, and law enforcement can actually depend on the community, because law enforcement needs the community, and certainly the community needs law enforcement. When you're talking about an essential service, law enforcement certainly would top the list.
Now, you've written that you believe that the vast majority of police officers are good officers doing their best in their jobs, but that there is a small minority of officers who can be overly aggressive, violent, bigoted. How do you think police departments could be doing a better job disciplining or removing those officers? And is the police union factor part of the problem?
Well, let me just say that I do think that we can be a little more proactive to walk you through the process. First thing, law enforcement too often migrate into this attitude of us and them, and that just kind of emphasized the fact that the officers themselves, they have to look out for each other because of the type job that it is. It's a dangerous job, of course. And let me just say, most law enforcement officers would not hesitate to put their life on the line to protect citizens. And they do that on a daily basis. But there are a few officers out there, a small percentage overall, that might be crossing the line. And I truly believe that the officers that work with them, they know who a lot of those officers are, and also believe that some of their supervisors and command officers know who they are. So I just think they need to be more proactive in weeding them out before we, you know, turn them loose on the citizens of Jacksonville, and you end up with a situation that not only tank that officer, but stain the badge in general. So it's in those officers' best interest and those command officers and sheriffs and chiefs' best interest to, you know, ferret those bad officers out, be proactive in taking the kinds of actions that would get them off the street before there is a significant incident. Mm-hmm. And too often that significant incident turned out to be a deadly incident. So we need to do that. Now, police unions are unions, and that's pretty much what they do. They protect their officers, and sometimes they are not particularly concerned about how good an officer is or how bad an officer is. Their job is to protect them. Mm-hmm. So we got to be a little creative in approaching that, because I do not think that whatever situation is that we should put a police officer on the street with a badge and a gun because of some agreement made with a police union or any collective bargaining unit. And so we're going to have to figure out a way to keep them off the street. Hmm. And there are things that we can do, some intervention, transfers, reassignment, and if necessary, termination.
Hmm. You know, years ago, before I was working at WJCT, I was sent by a former boss of mine to a leadership seminar at JU that you were leading. And I'll never forget a remark you made. It stayed with me for many years. You said, if you're in any position in an organization, leadership or rank and file, whatever you're doing, whenever you're out in the community, you're representing your organization, even if you're just running out to get a bottle of milk at the grocery store, whatever. And you said, someone's always watching. So wherever you are, you're an ambassador for your company, and someone's always watching what you're saying, what you're doing, and that is reflecting on the organization you serve. And I thought that was really good advice, and I've always tried to keep that in my mind in the role that I have now. And I think that goes for the police or any organization. And with the advent of social media and cell phones, people really are always watching, because these incidents that have been caught on smartphone video, that has really, more than anything, has sparked the calls for change. And so what are your thoughts about how our culture, which is now being able to observe incidents with their own eyes, how that has changed the conversation about police reform?
Change is a mild word to use. It has revolutionized it, to be honest with you. And it's been, as I indicated, a long time coming. Law enforcement is a part of the criminal justice system, but it is the only part of the criminal justice system that allow a unilateral decision to take a life, and that's the police. If that officer believes that his life or some citizen's life danger in certain felonious-type situations, they can use deadly force. Law enforcement officers are taught you do not pull that weapon unless you have the right to take a life. We don't pull it to shoot guns out of people's hand or shoot people in the leg and that kind of thing. If you don't, of course, kill them and shoot them in the leg, that's fine, but and you did take a life, that's always a good thing. But that's real serious. When you look at the other part of the criminal justice system, like the state attorney's office, they wrestle with this notion over a period of time to decide if they're going to recommend the death penalty for someone. And judges wrestle with the decision for weeks and sometimes months before they decide to send somebody to death. But police officers are put in a position where they have to make a quick decision sometime in fractions of a second to take a life. So their job is certainly critical. And to be honest with you, most of these actions now are turning up on their body cams in the instances where police officers have these cams on, or some persons actually taking a video of it with their telephone, their cell phone. And as you know, almost everyone has a cell phone.
That's right.
So it's serious now.
It is. And I want to thank you so much for lending your insights to this conversation. And congratulations, Nat Glover, on the recognition. It's well deserved. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you for that, Melissa. Well, today is International Yoga Day, and First Coast Yoga and Meditation leader Don Nivens is on the line now. Dan Nivens is on the line now, to explain why it's a perfect time for everybody, no pun intended, to give it a try or to further your practice. Dan, good morning.
Good morning, Charles. How are you, my friend?
All right, doing great. Listen, I am a fan of anyone who practices yoga on a consistent basis, because I haven't been able to do it more than a week at a time. So this is a learning experience for me as well as our listeners. So tell me, how did you get into yoga?
Absolutely. Well, I can tell you this. I think I spent a career in the military. I was severely wounded in combat, lost both legs below the knee, lived with a traumatic brain injury. And that just sort of the cultural shift for me, at least from the military kind of dude culture, to even consider practicing yoga would be a stretch. But now for me to be a yoga teacher, I mean, it had to be something pretty monumental. And so for me, it was in probably the darkest moment of my life. 8 years ago, it had surgery number 36 on my right leg, couldn't wear a leg, couldn't walk, couldn't do the things I used to do to cope with the invisible wounds of war. And for me, that all the coping skills and tools that I had were physical, and I couldn't do those. And I was really at rock bottom, really experiencing the sort of suffering from the invisible wounds of war for the first time, because I had a great involvement in my life from Wounded Warrior Project and these great coping tools, but then I couldn't use those. And a friend of mine said, "Dan, you need some yoga in your life." And I said, "That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard." And I meant it. And I think a lot of people might resonate with them, and they might identify with that. But then I finally said, "Well, I have nothing to lose." So I started with meditation, and then it was three private lessons of yoga. It had to be private because I didn't want to be with weird yoga people. And the first practice was torture, and all of them were a little bit of torture. But I had a very real moment on a yoga mat where, I had been practicing with my legs on, my prosthetic legs on. I decided to take them off, and nobody got to see me with my legs off. It was a huge leap for me, the sort of shame, because my legs were my best feature, at least that's what I thought. Mm-hmm. And so when I lost those, there was a lot of shame, guilt, grief, all these things rolled into one. And so here I am years later, finally sort of accepting my body,
yeah,
as it was. And in that moment, I got this sense of connection to the earth that was so powerful because I'd been floating above it on prosthetics, like refusing to acknowledge that my body wasn't complete anymore. Mm-hmm. And then I just had this realization that my body is complete and perfect just as it is. And that woke me up. It was like the earth was saying, Dan, where have you been for the last 10 years?
Yeah, that sounds, you know, like you had, you know, some type of, I don't know, metamorphosis with your connection with your body and yoga. But what are some of the benefits that you receive from that? And why should people, you know, seek yoga as a form of exercise or routine?
Oh, absolutely. Charles, I cannot, I mean, I could talk for hours about the benefits of yoga, but I'll just say it succinctly like this. Is there's not a more powerful practice on the planet that I've discovered yet that does as much for your body, your mind, and your overall well-being than the practice of yoga. And it is accessible to anyone, anybody. A lot of people would like balk at that, but I've taught people who are completely paralyzed, quadriplegics, and you can still practice yoga in the subtle body. So whatever your disability, your range of motion, you know, a lot of people say, well, I'm not flexible enough to do yoga. And I say, well, that's like saying you're too dirty to take a bath. Like, just show up
and start.
Do the practice.
Yeah.
And without any judgment on making it right. And in that experience and in those moments, it just becomes one of the most beautiful, accessible, easy, attainable, free practices that you can possibly do for your health and overall well-being.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about your efforts to get others to try yoga.
Charles, I am the evangelist. I am the guy, because I was the person totally, you know, against it. So I work a lot with the military community and the Wounded Warrior community, especially to my work with Wounded Warrior Project, to really introduce people, because there's this sort of, there is a sort of stigma that's associated with yoga, especially in the communities that I sort of walk around in. And so my goal is just to break those barriers down and just introduce people to the practice of meditation and of yoga literally the best medicine that I could possibly prescribe to someone for overall well-being. So I go to work every day, enrolling people, recruiting people, whatever, evangelizing for the practice of yoga and meditation, which is actually, you know, part of the eight limbs of yoga, to really get a better understanding of who we are, because it's an inner practice. It's a physical outer practice, but all in all, it is a practice of realizing that we have everything we need right now to heal from whatever is in front of us.
Okay. That's great information, Dan, and we appreciate it. I do, especially because I've been trying to get back into yoga for a while, and I have not been successful at it, but I'm going to take your information to heart. I'm sure our listeners will too as well. Dan Nevins, thank you very much for joining us this morning on First Coast Connect, and you have a great day.
Thanks, brother.
We'll be right back.
Dr. Glenn Doran, lead archaeologist on the remarkable Wendover Dig and longtime chair of anthropology at FSU, has died. I'm Ben Brookmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll share our last interview with Glenn Doran. We'll discuss the mermaids of Wickiwatchee and Miami's McFarlane Homestead Historic District. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Tanya Mosley. Dax Devlin Ross asks the question, how could his white friends be better allies? He writes to them in his latest book.
The way we talk about race in America tends to focus explicitly on how racism impacts and influences the lives of people of color and black folks, but I really want my white friends to recognize that it impacts them too.
Next time on Here and Now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9. On the next Fresh Air, Desus and Miro, hosts of the Showtime comedy series Desus and Miro, in which they riff on politics, pop culture, viral videos, sports, and the Bronx, where they each grew up in the 80s and 90s. We'll hear how graffiti, hip-hop, books, and jobs like collecting dead rats have figured into their lives. Join us
today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
In Hawaii, the federal government is returning something that was never really theirs. 80 acres earmarked for housing mainland Americans on the island is being transferred to native Hawaiian islanders. Reporters from the Honolulu Star-Advertiser and ProPublica tell us why this move took so long and what it might mean for other fights over ancestral lands. Next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Jacksonville attorney Jimmy Midyat ran for office in the city last year, arguing that wedding ceremonies needed to be restored at the Duval County Courthouse. The wedding stopped happening after marriage equality became the law of the land. He lost that clerk of courts race, but Midyat has only just begun. Last week, he spoke with Melissa Ross about his new role with Equality Florida. Take a listen.
Hey, Jimmy. Good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Melissa. Glad to be here.
So a big new role for you with Equality Florida. How did this come about and what are your priorities for the organization here in this part of the state?
Well, it is a big role. They were advertising the position and I decided that I wanted it. So mm-hmm. I applied and began that quest. After running for elected office last year, I decided to take a little time off and really find the right opportunity for me, and this is certainly that. So what I'm going to be working on primarily is raising funds, doing development in the Jacksonville market for Equality Florida, and also a little bit in Tallahassee and maybe even Panama City too, just covering the whole north part of the state.
Yeah,
working for equality.
And let's talk about that picture in Florida. Of course, in recent weeks, there's been a lot of discussion during Pride Month about these issues. The most recent flashpoint was the controversy over rainbow lights on the Acosta Bridge, but that's by far the only issue. So when you look at how Florida has come along on these issues and how it hasn't, how would you assess the state in terms of its road toward equality for the LGBTQ community?
You know, Florida has come a long way in some ways. Let's set aside this month for one second. In the aftermath of the Supreme Court decision in Bostock a year ago that made equality the law of the land in terms of hiring, public accommodations, and employment, and housing. That decision came to Florida as well. And so our own Florida Commission for Human Relations, which is the state agency that hears those complaints and helps resolve them, has announced that LGBTQ people are covered under Florida's existing human rights law, very similar to our HRO that we passed in Jacksonville. So that's a big change. That's a big win. Now, there are other issues, clearly, having to do with transgender students and their participation in schools. Governor signed that law into effect on the very first day of Pride. The governor also vetoed some funding for the Pulse nightclub survivors, their mental health, and also some dollars for LGBTQ youth in Central Florida. So, you know, here in the state, there's a lot of challenges with the officials and with the legislature that we have right now, but it's ironically a good time for us nationally, including in Florida, because of some of the new protections.
Right. And, you know, it's interesting to kind of take stock because gosh, marriage equality only became the law of the land less than 10 years ago. This culture has moved a lot in a short time.
It has. It has moved a lot, and I understand that majorities of all categories, I believe now, in terms of political affiliation, now support marriage equality or same-sex marriage, including more than 50% of Republicans, which is tremendous. There has been a cultural ground shift, a groundswell that has shifted in this, in the country. But here in Florida, we still have some work to do.
Yeah. And so how do you see Equality Florida advocating in that way? And what are the big priorities for your organization?
Sure. So Equality Florida next year will celebrate its 25th year of operations in Florida doing this work. And this is a great time for me to join and to reiterate that Jacksonville is a really important part of the statewide work. So that's one of the reasons why I've come on board, and that's why I'm here. So, and over the next year, I know we'll be looking, Equality Florida will be looking much more closely at how to protect students, all students, LGBTQ especially. And that'll be a big part of our strategy. We also have some work that we're doing around safe schools generally and around the decriminalization of HIV status. So there are challenges that we have ahead of us, but we're really well positioned to tackle them.
We'll continue to follow along with it. In the meantime, congrats on the new role, and keep us posted. He's Jimmy Midyet, now with Equality Florida. Thanks, Jimmy.
Thank you, Melissa.
And that's our program. Thanks to all of our listeners out there. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is our director. Our editorial director is Jessica Palumbo. And Bill Bortsville is our digital editor. Have questions or comments about First Coast Connect? Send an email to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. I'm Charles Griggs, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow, but if you missed anything, you can listen to the replay on wjct.org or your favorite podcast platform. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.